Welcome to Virtual Economy, a podcast about the business of games for the rest of us. We're your hosts. I'm Amanda Farrow.
And I'm Michael Footer.
Each episode, we'll cover the biggest business beats and bring in expert commentary from lawyers, analysts, and industry pros. This is episode 80. CD Projekt's Ship Now, Apologize Later strategy worked. Sorta.
Sorta.
A little. So how are you? Also,
How are you feeling?
I mean, I'm not 100%, but I'm sure better than I was yesterday where I laid on the couch and watched Disney movies all day.
So for those of you who don't follow us on Twitter or aren't in our Discord, we both had our second vaccines this week.
Yeah, and our second round of Fauci ouchies.
It's no joke, folks. If you have not yet had your vaccines, just carve out some time around the second one.
Carve out a couple of days for the second one. Honestly, the morning after I got mine, it felt like someone had punched me so hard in my left arm, which is my non-dominant arm, that I couldn't move it all that well. And then I had kind of like this weird fever nonsense all day off and on. And the night before, I just felt stoned.
Let me just tell you something. When I woke her up banging on a cowbell, I found out the hard way that the only she had a fever, that the cure was not more cowbell.
You don't even own a cowbell. Still not a cowbell. All right, so even though this is a day late, because I was a mess yesterday, a glorious mess, but a mess nonetheless.
Yeah,
we have you know, a fairly chunky episode, especially around M&As.
Yeah, there's some interesting stuff. This episode spans the spectrum of business stories. We're going to start off. Microsoft had a busy week this week.
Microsoft did have a busy week this week. First up, Microsoft has, as expected, told Apple to pound sand.
That's right. Xbox Cloud Gaming, which I guess is the full name of the service formerly known as xCloud, has launched in limited beta on iOS devices, and it's also on PC. iOS users who received an invite will access the service via a website. It's essentially a progressive web app like Amazon's Luna service, or the way people are accessing Google Stadia now.
Absolutely. VentureBeat also has reported that Microsoft is working with startup Rainway to ensure low latency play in the cloud. That is super important because, as we know, if you can tell the difference between playing a game on your device versus playing a game in the cloud, cloud gaming is almost always worse.
It is. And the idea, ideally, cloud gaming is seamless. You absolutely just forget, oh yeah, I'm not playing this locally on my device. It's somewhere else and being served to me. Mm-hmm. My experience with cloud gaming, I have not yet had that experience.
Same here.
So we shall see. Also this week, Microsoft announced ID at Azure, which is similar to its ID at Xbox program. The idea here is to encourage indies to work with Microsoft's cloud computing platform, and that's going to launch this summer.
Windows Central also broke the news this week that Microsoft is planning a major revamp for the Windows 10 Store app. Thank goodness.
Yes.
Because right now it is clunky, unwelcoming, frustrating to navigate. I could go on and on about all of the UI and UX problems, but that's for like a Twitter thread.
Yeah. We've had our share of problems. So this is absolutely welcome news. So what Windows Central is saying, Microsoft is going to remove some of its more onerous restrictions. And that includes making it easier for developers to publish on the Windows 10 store.
Absolutely.
They're going to remove the requirement to package apps specifically for that store. So instead of having to package those apps, you'll be able to publish EXE and MSI files.
That's definitely going to remove some barriers to access for that. It will also transition to a system that allows developers to update their apps via their own content distribution networks, mm-hmm. so they don't have to rely on whatever it is that the Windows Store uses.
Absolutely. That's, again, huge. And in another blow to Apple...
Did Microsoft tell Apple to pound sand
twice?
Part deux?
Yes. It's going to welcome third-party payment options.
Ooh.
So this essentially will allow game developers and other app developers to monetize directly through their games and apps without using the store giving Microsoft a cut.
Absolutely.
So if you decide to play a free-to-play game, for instance, if mm-hmm. you decide to play Fortnite on PC and I mean, why wouldn't you play it on the Epic Games Store? But let's just use Fortnite as an example. And you download through the Windows 10 store. Sure. And you buy V-Bucks.
Mm-hmm.
Epic will get that money without Microsoft taking a cut off the top.
Right.
So the same thing would go for something like Warframe or Warface. Or there's some. Oh, remember there were like those three games.
I
remember. Warframe, Warface, and something else.
It's War something.
Yep.
I don't even remember. So anyway, the most important thing about this is that this is moving more towards openness,
mm-hmm.
and it's starting to pull down the walls that created these walled garden software ecosystems. And as you noted in our show notes, UWP, which is
it's Universal Windows Program.
Universal Windows Program. I always forget that. Like, I know what UWP is conceptually, but I'm so bad with acronyms. So it was considered by some, including Epic founder Tim Sweeney, as a, quote, harbinger of doom.
Yeah, the idea there, and I think this was, gosh, was this back in 2016, I think? Where Tim Sweeney was talking about how, maybe it was even earlier than this, where Tim Sweeney was talking about how it's like, oh, well, if Microsoft, you know, if UWP becomes a standard and that becomes the way you have to publish on Windows, then suddenly Microsoft has all the control.
Well, and he wasn't wrong. No. He absolutely was not wrong. And again, if we take a look at what current leadership is like at Microsoft, we know that they are more about pulling down barriers to entry with everything to do with Windows more and more, and that includes Xbox.
It's this interesting shift because at that point, obviously, Tim Sweeney was really upset at Microsoft, and now they're allies in this fight against Apple.
It's very... They're tech giants. Like, we don't stand corporations
no,
in this
house. We certainly don't.
So, in additional news with Microsoft, Microsoft unlocked free-to-play games for non-Xbox Live members, which means that these games are no longer behind the paywall.
Right. This brings parity with PlayStation Network, because Absolutely. It's been a number of years since you had to pay for... I don't know if you actually ever had to pay for free-to-play on
that
PlayStation Network.
That I don't know. I'm not sure if I've ever played a free-to-play game on PlayStation.
I know I played Warframe. There was another game at launch, Blackout, was it called?
Oh gosh, no.
Blacklight?
I don't know. I have not played a free-to-play game on anything other than my phone or my computer.
Yeah, I will say this. I don't think... I've had Xbox Live since it started without any gap, and I've had PlayStation...
Oh, same here.
PlayStation Network, PlayStation Plus. That's the one I'm thinking of.
PlayStation Plus, yes.
Since it launched as well. So I've never been without, my recollection is that you never needed PlayStation Plus to play free-to-play games. This brings parity. Microsoft also previously brought a number of apps be in front of the paywall that used to be. So it used to be you need an Xbox Live account in order to access Netflix.
Interesting. Yeah. I did not know that because it would not occur to me to use Xbox for Netflix.
I used to all the time. We used to in the office, actually.
Oh, before we got this smart TV.
Before we got the smart TV, yeah.
Right. Okay, so what's the next thing on the docket for Microsoft?
So you might recall that Microsoft has been facing a lawsuit over controller drift, just like Nintendo.
Yeah, I remember.
Over the Joy-Con stuff,
it was
right?
filed by the same law firm.
You are correct. And that has now been moved to arbitration. That is effectively a win for Microsoft.
Yeah, because that's behind closed doors. So you know, we will not hear the outcome of this as a result.
We'll probably hear the outcome, but not the proceedings.
Not the details.
There's a good chance that given the engineering teardowns, remember there was the really cool teardown of the Joy-Con
issue. Loved that. That was such a smart way of presenting the intrinsic hardware issues.
Mm-hmm. And I think there was something similar for the Xbox controller, and the issue was with the potentiometer, I think.
Interesting.
So there may be a settlement, as we said. We'll find out that part of it, or if we don't hear anything, I guess no settlement. But as you mentioned, all the proceedings are going to be behind closed doors.
So it's not going to be a part of public record.
No.
You know what is part of the public record, though? Our hopes being dashed.
Yes. Every day on this earth.
Every day on this earth. Not to be a Debbie Downer, but our hopes of Discord Nitro being permanently bundled with Xbox Game Pass seems to have been dashed.
Yeah, the Wall Street Journal is reporting that Discord has broken off talks, not just with Microsoft, but with all suitors, which means that it has chosen to walk down the eventual IPO path rather than look at acquisition.
Either of these decisions were really smart. I mean, Discord has, quite frankly, first mover advantage. And now that they have some serious competition with Guilded, mm-hmm. it'll be interesting to see the decisions that they end up making. Like, are they going to, you know, are they going to, they're, I don't think that they're going to move back to having a storefront, but what are they going to do to continue to help with these communities? I feel like we're starting to see Discord move more towards communities than just, you know, like one, like talking in group chats or whatever. I feel like the servers and the communities are going to continue to become an important piece of
it. But let's talk a little bit about first mover advantage. Like, obviously Guilded is touting a number of things that are either behind the Discord paywall or that Discord doesn't offer.
Discord doesn't offer the vast majority of what Guilded offers for free.
And one of those things is like 256 kilobit per second. Voice chat. Now, that is something you eventually unlock on Discord if your server gets boosted.
If you boost the server,
Boosting a server is not like, oh, I boosted it twice, and then I boosted it twice more, and I boosted it twice more, and eventually you boost it enough times. No, it's a subscription. The boost has to, like, because I looked into this for our server.
Oh,
and it would be extremely expensive for us to get to tier 2, let alone to tier 3. I think it would be $40 a month to get to tier 2.
Not worth it. Not worth it for us.
For a month, I paid for like 2 boosts for us. And it's like, oh, okay. And then it's like, okay, we build you for your 2 boosts. I'm like, oh, I completely misunderstood how this works. That actually makes more sense that that's how they get their recurrent revenue.
Yeah. I definitely misunderstood that as well myself.
Yeah, you get 2 free boosts with your Nitro subscription.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not like you get, think of it, it's not like your Amazon Prime Twitch subscription where you get to allocate that wherever you want every month.
Right.
It is. No, if you pick 2, like, so I have our server boosted twice every month. It just renews those 2.
Got it.
As opposed to giving you 2 more and adding on to, it's not a meter that builds up.
Oh, it's not like my channel points on Twitch.
Yeah, there you go. So that's really interesting. But here's the thing about first mover advantage. Guilded has to offer these things in order to woo people away from the first
because
mover.
Because what is super, super duper expensive? What is
User acquisition.
Oh, user acquisition, like we talk about almost every episode.
Which is why Mixer having that extremely low latency, what was it called? Hyperspeed?
No, it was called, oh shit.
Lightspeed. Yeah,
I
something
believe.
Like that. It
For
was
Beam.io.
Right. So essentially the big lure of Mixer was, I say it and the community hears it less than a second later, instead of having that giant lag that still exists on Twitch.
It's at least 3 seconds depending on
Is it shorter for partners? Because it's still, it's more than 3 seconds for affiliates. I know that.
For me, it's only 3 seconds.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, I timed it yesterday.
Oh, okay.
Because remember, we have our countdowns when we go live. So I sync it between the two to see what the latency looks like for me personally.
Oh, that's smart. I'm glad you did that. 3 seconds is a lot of time while you're streaming, though. If you're in the middle of making a decision in a game or you're running somewhere and someone's like, oh no, you have to turn right here, and you are 3 seconds in game time past that. Which, it's like, wait, where?
What?
And of course, it would have been great to not have that integrated with Facebook gaming.
Yeah.
But to have it, you know, with Twitch. I hope Twitch is continuing to invest in that because that is the biggest bummer on Twitch right now. Well, No. It is one of many big bummers on Twitch.
It is one of many bummers on Twitch right now, up to and including its toxic tendencies.
So when we talk about Guilded offering things that Discord doesn't, that's not necessarily a big scary thing for Discord,
Discord feels
like, okay, we need to do all these things right now.
Remember, it's all about innovation, right?
Right.
That competition always breeds innovation.
Absolutely. Now, Discord has apparently sent out a marketing survey to users saying, hey, which of these services matter to you?
Absolutely.
So that they can figure out where they want to prioritize. So
and
I don't know if
normal.
256 kilobit voice chat is going to matter. Like for us.
Not necessarily.
Yeah.
I mean, we have this podcast,
mm-hmm.
which is encoded at 256, I believe. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't, like, for me personally, it doesn't necessarily matter. What I want more of is like being able to have events right in our server so that I don't have to like either write my own API hooks and like have my own apps, or, you know, figure out how to tie in Google Calendar. Point being, there are some really interesting things that Guilded is doing that I do hope comes over to Discord.
Mm-hmm.
I don't need the 256.
Yeah, there are some other things I'm not... I saw the list.
Yeah. It's you know, it's impressive what Gilded is doing.
Oh, events? Oh, and being able to preview servers and things like that. There are some things that Discord could certainly use, but this is the right first step for them. It's like, okay, which of these services actually matter to our users? And then they'll focus there.
Give me an events calendar. That's what I care about.
Absolutely. So that was a big week for Microsoft. I'm personally a little bummed about the Discord news. I think there was a really good fit there with Microsoft, as I wrote about on the site.
Absolutely.
On the virtual economy site. So good luck to them, though. I mean, IPOs, tech IPOs right now kind of are a little bit down, but we'll see what happens by the time, because they're not ready yet.
No, I would imagine this is still another couple of years out.
Yep. And in terms of why they made this choice, they might not have gotten the offers they wanted. They might not have been able to keep control the way they wanted.
Certainly.
They might have had to make compromises in ways that they didn't want to make compromises.
Well, and I mean, as we've talked about on the show before, when it comes to contracts, it is all about finding that middle ground and knowing what your wants and your needs look like. And if their wants were being met, but their needs weren't, then it doesn't make any sense to go forward with an acquisition or a merger.
I still would love to see console-level Discord integration. But I know that that's a real tricky thing for both Sony and Microsoft, let alone Nintendo. Because then you're seeding
Nintendo,
control...
Nintendo is a non-starter. They can't even handle their own voice apps, because everything has to go through your phone. They don't even have it natively on the console. Anyway... Let's move forward and talk about our next story, which is about Humble.
Right. So Humble, which is a company that made its name by supporting charities through game, app, and book bundles, they've made some users pretty unhappy this week.
All right. So walk me through what happened here, because I was offline for the most part this week because I'm drowning in work.
Yeah. So I think this popped up on Friday, so a couple days ago. So as you know, so Humble started with the bundles, right? And it was all indie games. It was the Humble Indie Bundle.
Yeah, absolutely. Right? And I've been supporting Humble Bundle for a number of years, and I think I've had the Humble Choice for...
You've had it a lot longer than I have.
6 years?
And that's essentially $12 a month plus tax, and you get a selection of... So it was just a fixed bundle, right?
It was
a blind bundle. You didn't know... what you were getting. Sorry, that was ableist. It was a sealed
mystery.
Bundle. A mystery bundle. There you go.
It was a mystery bundle.
So it was a mystery bundle. You didn't know what you were going to get. Now what they have is they announce the games up front. And most months you get to choose certain, depending on your tier, you get to choose a certain number of them. And we're grandfathered in because we had the original Humble Choice. And now... it was Humble Monthly.
It was Humble Monthly, and now it's Humble Choice.
So they also have the Humble Store, and they publish games. So the company has
diversified.
Grown. It has diversified and has grown. So what they announced was they are doing away with the sliders on the classic Humble Bundle. So the way that worked was each Humble Bundle supports one or more charities.
Indeed.
And when you make your gift, it's a pay what you want, but there are different tiers. So pay anything and you get the lowest tier. And then it's pay more than the... average and you get the next tier, and pay up to $15 or pay $20 or more and you get the next tier. And the way it used to be was at the bottom of that there were sliders. One was for Humble, so how much you want Humble to get for their quote tip for putting all of this together and running the business. One was for the publishers. And then there were multiple sliders. There was a slider for each charity. So assuming there was one charity, you'd have three sliders. And as you move the sliders, the other sliders moved to give you a different proportion of how much of your money. So let's say it's a $20 bundle, right? Let's say you're kicking in $20. You could slide that all the way to the charity and give all $20 to the charity. You could split it so that Humble got $1 and then the charity got $17 and then the publisher got $2. You could manipulate that however you want. You could type the numbers in and have it split up however you want.
Yep, I understand that. So the fact that they are moving away from the sliders, they actually do have a statement that they provided. So, quote, "Since we launched bundles over a decade ago, sliders have not changed, even as Humble evolved by building products like Humble Choice and the Humble Store that all support charity without sliders."
Now, my reaction to this is, the fact that you can donate some of your Humble Store purchases to charity is awesome. The fact that Humble Choice supports charity is awesome. But to homogenize all of these different offerings and say, well, these others support charity without sliders, kind of, to me, defeats the whole idea of the Humble Bundle.
Yeah, I tend to agree. I think that what made Humble so special is that it gave an immense amount of control to the consumer to say, no, this is what my values are. I want to support both the publisher and I want to support the charity and I want to give a little bit to Humble, or I want to give a lot to the publisher and a little to charity. I mean,
or nothing to the publisher and give 25% to Humble and 75% to the charity. Now, remember, I believe THQ was the very first AAA publisher to be a non-indie publisher on Humble Bundle. That caused a huge row, like, oh, it's Humble Indie and they're not indie and what are we doing? And it was a moment where if I'm remembering correctly, it was towards the end of days for THQ. They mm-hmm. needed cash. Mm-hmm. And that was one of the ways they did it.
Yeah.
So what they're going to be doing is, instead of toggles, there's going to be a default split. 5% to charity, 10% to Humble, and the remaining 85% to the publisher, based on the example that they showed, the mock-up that they showed.
Okay.
There is a second option that says extra to charity that bumps the portion for charitable giving to 15%, reduces the Humble portion to 5%, and the publisher portion to 80%. So the max you will be able to give to charity through a traditional Humble bundle with the multiple tiers is going to be 15%.
Hmm.
And of course, the replies,
yeah,
they are getting drowned in angry replies.
Well, and this also, to me, it really does fly in the face of the really amazing stuff that they have been doing, not just with indies, but with diversity and inclusion, with their Black Developers Fund that they started last year and they're still continuing to roll out. You know, this feels weird.
It does. And users are pinning this move on Humble's acquisition by Ziff Davis in 2017.
Oh, right, yeah.
As you might recall, Ziff Davis is a large media company. They own IGN.
Among others.
Yep, and people are actually saying this is IGN's fault.
Okay.
Which does not make sense.
No, IGN is not calling the shots here. This is likely a Ziff Davis perspective and saying, listen, we're not making as much money as we want to make. This is capitalism.
Yes.
But if Humble was not acquired by Ziff Davis in 2017, who knows if they'd still be around today?
Right. Now, they also took VC money.
Yes, I remember.
Yeah, they took venture capitalist funding back in like 2010.
Yeah.
And it was to the tune of about $5.5 million, if I recall, and it was Sequoia.
Oh, Sequoia.
Yes.
Sequoia is everywhere in the game industry.
So I had a number of questions when I read this. And the first is, are publishers driving this? And by that, I mean, has it become harder to secure games for what are effectively dirt cheap bundles of good games?
Yeah, exactly. Because we're not just seeing games that we don't know or that are lesser known. We're seeing games like Control and Age of Wonders Planetfall. Like, we're seeing games that are made by large studios being included in these bundles mm-hmm. these days.
Absolutely. And the Humble portion is still very low. Of course, the follow-up question here is, was the traditional Humble bundle, was that not recouping its cost? Is this an issue of we're losing money on this?
Yeah, and that's the big question for me. And obviously because they don't, you know, release their financials to the public,
mm-hmm.
we don't know what things looked like or what the trajectory of that has looked like mm-hmm. over the years. And maybe it turns out that the classic Humble Bundle was a black hole.
Sure. And it might have been. Now, remember, it originally started purely as a charity effort.
It did. So, and it's grown into something that is much bigger than that.
It has morphed from a small charity-driven endeavor into a grassroots endeavor to a for-profit initiative at a major media conglomerate. So, yeah, the complexion is going to change on something like that.
Mm-hmm.
My next question was, because they admitted that they had been secretly testing this without telling people, and they got emails about it. People were like, where are my sliders?
Right.
So how much of a trust fall was this? Like, and how much did this cause trust issues? And I think it did. I think that when you admit to people that you got caught doing it.
Instead of announcing and getting in front of the story,
mm-hmm.
that it feels a lot like a bait and switch.
Yeah. I went to Humble Bundle. I purchase Humble Bundles because I'm able to support charity, and you took away the sliders.
This aligns with my values. Yep.
thank you. You know what? That's a perfect way to look at it. People purchasing Humble Bundles and feeling good about throwing money at things that they might not have otherwise done because it aligns with their values, which I'm going to jump to the last one of my questions here is, does this move hurt the brand? And my answer, especially based on what you just said, if, and this is the tone of the comments that I saw, I'm not going to shop at Humble Bundle anymore. It no longer aligns with my values, as you said.
Certainly. And I mean, if we look at this from a broader marketing perspective, and this comes down to generational values, you know, millennials and zennials especially, we care more about where our money goes and how we are improving either the planet or the people or the companies that we are essentially voting with our dollars. Before us, it wasn't about that. It was just about, well, whatever's cheapest, whatever is the quality that I'm looking for. And now there are social values attached to the goods and services that we go out and spend our very hard-earned money on. We don't have a lot of it, so we have to be very careful about the companies and the initiatives that we're supporting. And this really does come down to generational values. If you value people and planet and profit, you have to vote with your wallet.
Absolutely. Now, it's not like they're abandoning their charity initiatives altogether. Not. Humble was one of the first companies to step up for Black creators last summer, especially, and mm-hmm. they doubled down on that and threw more money at supporting Black creators, which right. is starting to bear fruit. We know that there have been a number of games that have been signed.
Yeah, absolutely.
With prototype funding that may go on
it's
to full publishing.
It's not that Humble is bad. Right. Humble is not a bad company. It is that this is no longer value aligned for a lot of people based on the comments that you saw.
Mm-hmm. And the other thing for me is that, you know, obviously publishers are getting a bigger chunk of this now, mm-hmm. but I put this question out on Twitter, did not get many responses. When I was talking to people when I was writing the books, we had some conversations about Humble. I don't think anything about Humble made it into the books,
mm-hmm.
but I asked, it's like, okay, so how much do you typically assume to get from a single game in a larger bundle? Remember, they're not all public. There are publisher bundles, like Sega's done bundles, but a lot of times there are games from multiple publishers.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right?
In fact, most of the time there are games from multiple publishers.
So the assumption here is that if you get $1 per game
mm-hmm.
in a Humble, if you average out to $1 per bundle purchased that has one of your games in it, you're doing okay.
Mm-hmm.
Which is why when the whole Psychonauts 2 campaign popped up on Fig and they're like, look at how many copies we sold. It's like, you were in a Humble Bundle. Like, that doesn't translate to a lot of money. Like, they were making an investment case. So
what it really came down to, especially with the original, with the classic Humble Bundle, is that this is optics yeah. of being in a Humble Bundle.
Sure.
It was and may continue to be considered to be, you know, a boon.
Mm-hmm.
It's
Absolutely.
Not just about the quick shot of revenue. It is about, we are associated with a reputable brand, with people that believe in what we, and therefore Humble, are doing.
Yeah, again, coming back to value alignment. The other thing is, Humble's a great tool for raising awareness and building an install base before a sequel.
Mm-hmm.
Or now, because there are more AAA and service-based games that are getting folded in, you can ease people in with a very low bar to entry, and then if they're interested, if they like your game, then you have someone, it's user acquisition, right?
Absolutely.
Then you've got recurrent revenue, potentially.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that that's a really important piece of the puzzle when we're talking about, you know, why even be in a Humble Bundle if you're only getting, like, $1.
Yeah. I think that ultimately, my last question here was, will they back down? I think that there are going to have to be some changes. I don't know if they're going to back down fully. But
I don't think they're going to back down fully. I think that their hands are likely very tied, and that this is not necessarily driven internally.
Yeah.
But that this comes down to a combination of factors. One of them is probably Ziff Davis.
Mm-hmm.
The other being that this could very potentially be a black hole of, how do we stop the bleeding?
Absolutely. So I think capping charity at 15% has become the big... That has been the gravitational pull for negative comments. I used to be able to give 100,
that.
And now you're dialing it down to a max of 15. Like, that's not okay, that doesn't align with my values as a consumer and why I purchase from Humble.
Yeah.
And therefore, I will never purchase from Humble again, which is, of course, an overreaction and perhaps may not be true in the long run. But that is the sentiment that is building around this decision. So we will see.
We'll definitely keep an eye on this and see what Humble ends up deciding. It could be because they did not necessarily get out in front of this and tell the story in a proactive capacity, that they just won't address it.
Yep.
It could be that that's the case, but we won't know, and the only thing we can do is just continue to report what we do know.
Yep, we shall see. But now, it's time for M&A Minute.
It's never a minute.
I know. It's why M&A I'm going to keep the name M&A Minute, because it's ironic.
It's like, who are you? All right, let's talk about InvestGame. So InvestGame has released its Q1 Global Video Game Deals Reports.
Now, InvestGame is one of the sources we used when we wrote up our trends piece for the year. So this is actually cycling on some of that piece that we did, and it was the first thing we wrote on the website.
I know. Wasn't that nice? Remember, it was a simpler time.
Yep. So for the first quarter of 2021, this is what InvestGame has to say. It shows a strong footprint with 2x growth versus the first half of last year. So Q1 is 2x the first half of last year.
And so that's including private investments as well.
So private investments, IPOs, and M&As.
Wild.
Yep.
So that's twofold in each of those categories at least.
Yep.
M&As are like banana
pants. M&A is $14.3 billion versus $4 billion. Now remember, that includes Bethesda closing in that quarter. So that's half of that.
That's half.
More than half of that.
Yeah, so that's a lot. But here's the really interesting thing about this. 249 deals have been closed in Q1 of 2021 with a total value of $25 billion, plus over 30 transactions that have been announced but not yet closed, leading to the total deal value, hold on to your pants, of $39 billion for announced and closed deals. Tom Nook
getting
them bells.
Remember, we've been saying this was going to be a huge year for M&A, and now having this data behind it is...
Listen, we knew it was going to be a big year. We did not know it was going to be this big of a year this quickly. Who'd have thunk?
Yep. Tencent, which again, we've talked about this, leads the playing field with corporate investments and focus on PC and console. They've closed a total of 35 deals, including investments in overseas markets, Munfish, Don't Nod, Payload Studios, Bohemia Interactive, as well as they've continued to consolidate the Chinese gaming market with Surgical Scalpel Studio, Game Science, Ulta Zero Games, and Darkstar. We covered a few of those as well. So that's setting the table for this week's M&A. Because, like, that information hit, we wanted to lead with it because it really reinforces why we started doing M&A Minute. Winky face.
So let's talk about People Can Fly. So coming off the mostly successful release of Outriders, barring some technical concerns, People Can Fly has acquired Illinois studio Phosphor Games. And those are the developers behind the Brookhaven Experiment, Heroes Reborn, Gemini, and Nether. The studio is being renamed People Can Fly Chicago. No terms were disclosed, and PCF is currently working on another game for Square Enix and an original action-adventure game for Take-Two.
I wonder if they got a green light on Outriders 2 already.
You know, considering the mostly positive reception for the game, the only big complaints that I've heard from people is that they don't like the story, but they really enjoy the gameplay.
Yep. All right, let's see here. Focus Home Interactive has acquired Stroom On Studio. That's the team
behind... Stroom.
The team behind Space Hulk Deathwing and the...
So good!
Yeah, and the upcoming Necromunda Hired Gun. That's the FPS.
Which looks
good. No specific terms were disclosed except that the deal was paid in both cash and shares.
Keyword Studios continues to make moves. I've been covering Keyword Studios now for like 3 years and covering their massive expansion. So they are a game industry technical services provider. So they do like a little bit of everything. And by a little bit, I mean a lot of it, because there are a lot of people. So they have recently acquired Climax Studios. Climax has been around for 30 years in the UK and has worked as a co-development, porting, and support studio on games including... One of my favorite games.
I included this just for you.
Viva Pinata for PC. Diablo on
Diablo.
PS. Diablo, which we played last night, even because Halo didn't work. Halo did not, in fact, go burr. Diablo on PlayStation 1. Dirt Rally 2.0 in VR. Returnal, which is out next week for PlayStation 5. And many more. The studio also led development on the Assassin's Creed Chronicles trilogy.
That was a side-scroller trilogy in China, India, and Russia.
Yes. I think I played China. That might have been the only one I played.
Deal is worth 43 million pounds sterling, bringing 109 Climax staff members into the Keywords fold. Keyword currently has 65 locations in 22 countries in Asia, the Americas, and Europe.
They're a big ass corporation.
They're huge. They're huge.
So big. Like, holy molies. All right, what else is going on?
Lightheart Entertainment has announced its 6.8 million Series A funding round. Lightheart's first game, Mr. Autofire, has earned more than 10 million in revenue since its release in November 2019. Funding round was led by Makers Fund with existing investors Galaxy Interactive, Sisu Game Ventures, and new angel investors coming aboard. Lightheart Entertainment will use the funds to develop more hypercore games like Mr. Autofire. But what is hypercore? Lightheart describes these as hyper-casual titles with deep meta games and live ops.
Huh.
Interesting, right?
That is very interesting.
Mr. Autofire!
Mr. Autofire!
Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Autofire was my father. Please call me Bob.
Very nice. Multiverse has also secured its Series A funding in the amount of $17.5 million, with participation from Twitch co-founder Kevin Lin, Oculus co-founder Nate Mitchell, Team Solomid co-founder Andy Din, Crunchyroll co-founder Kun Gao, streamer Pokimane, Anthos Capital, and Makers Fund. Multiverse is behind the recently announced video game tabletop hybrid called One More Multiverse. The idea is to iterate and improve on the virtual tabletop space. Tabletop idea, sorry. A space that includes Roll20, Roll, and Foundry. One More Multiverse is in closed beta with a Q3 2021 planned release.
Yeah, so if you've ever, especially during the pandemic, services like Roll20 and Foundry have really...
Oh, I'm sorry. You mean like how we play D&D with our family that is over on the other side of the continent?
Yes.
That one.
So I'm interested to see what they've got going on. That's very cool.
I would like it when they go into open beta. Yes. I would like to test that out.
Me too. Last one for the day. Australian developer Mighty Kingdom has completed its IPO, raising $18 million US. The studio has released more than 50 games since it opened in 2010, including licensed mobile games in the Shopkins, Lego Friends, and Gabby's Dollhouse IP, and other original IP. The IPO puts the company's market cap at $46 million. Mighty Kingdom currently employs 110 people, and funding will be used to develop new IP and grow the studio.
Right on.
It's time for quick hits.
I'm so excited for when we eventually go to video and everyone can see that I literally do jazz hands every single time. Literally every time. So remember when you and I sat down and we had a big conversation about GameStonks?
Yes.
And how concerned we were that this was going to create some really messed up corporate shenanigans for GameStop?
Yeah.
Yeah, so that happened. GameStop has announced that CEO George Sherman is walking off into the wasteland.
But he's not going alone. He's taken with him sacks of bells worth $180 million as a result of GameStonk. As a result of the Reddit pumping, his stocks are going to be worth, and his exit package is going to be worth $180 million.
I don't think he earned that.
Nope.
I don't think he earned that literally at all. And that makes me really upset. Listen, I am all about creating your own wealth, and I am all about taking control of your finances, and I am all about power to the people. But also consider, George Sherman is walking away with big sacks of bells because of GameStop. So yep. He will be leaving the company on July 31st, and a search for his successor is already underway. I am looking forward to seeing who Ryan Cohen brings on board, I
exactly.
guess.
Exactly. Sony has reversed course on the shutdown of the PS3 Thank and Vita storefronts. Yeah, both stores will remain open. The PSP storefront will be shuttered on July 2nd as planned, and we think this means that PSP content will still be available for purchase on Vita, and that it's just the storefront access from the PSP that's going away. The blog post attributed to, but certainly not written by, Jim Ryan isn't quite clear on that. The other piece of news that popped up is someone engineered a Firefox plugin, because Sony took down the web store, the old web store that allowed you to actually purchase all of these PS1 classics and the PS3 games and Vita and PSP games on your mobile device or on your computer, they didn't actually take the stores down. They just screwed with the HTML to break the APIs, but someone figured it out. So we'll see how long that lasts. So if you're interested in getting onto that web store and purchasing some games before they're gone,
just go Google it.
They're already very difficult to access right now. I don't understand. And it's we're not having that conversation again.
We have had that conversation already, and what this really comes down to is values.
Yeah, we have a few more Sony quick hits. I'm going to jump ahead because I should have just grouped these together.
Okay.
PlayStation Now will begin streaming in 1080p this week for those games that support the resolution. I am shocked that it's not already in 1080p.
I wonder, like, I've seen what 720 looks like on a 4K television. It's not good.
It's not great.
It's not good.
Sony has signed a deal with Firewalk Studios, which is part of Harold Ryan's former Bungie exec. It's his probably Monsters group. Firewalk, which is led by Destiny vets, is working on a new multiplayer IP for Sony. Blog does not mention exclusivity, but since Sony is doing it, I imagine there is at very least timed exclusivity, maybe coming to PC later.
I would imagine so.
Because Sony has gotten a little wiser about that.
Additionally, this is an important get for Sony. Yes. Sony is not good at multiplayer games, like having multiplayer games specifically on their console.
Yeah, their single player offerings are fantastic.
Are incredible. They're absolutely incredible. There is no bones about that, but Microsoft has them cornered when it comes to multiplayer.
Yep. And Microsoft's, you know, their single player stuff hasn't been super strong.
It has not been. But I'm very interested to see how everything is going to go with their acquisitions of all of the various studios that
right.
they folded into Xbox Game Studios.
Right, so when those start to hit, so when we talk about Hellblade 2, when mm-hmm. we talk about Psychonauts 2, so all the games from the studios, whatever Compulsion's working on.
Whatever Compulsion is working on, I'm very interested to see as well, because I really did enjoy We Happy Few. Mm-hmm.
And the last one is Sony's testing a new PlayStation Plus video pass in Poland as a test market. The service will give access to more than 20 movie and TV shows from Sony Pictures, and new content will be added quarterly. So we'll see how that test goes and if it's something that they decide to bring to other platforms.
Okay, so let's talk about Call of Duty Warzone, which has hit 100 million downloads. No details as to platform breakdown or other stats were provided.
But still, a huge number.
That's
huge,
an enormous number.
It's going to be a shame when they have to give up the Warzone name from that lawsuit. I'm kidding.
Whoa.
I kid, because I love.
Hashtag first mover advantage.
Yep. 11bit's Frostpunk has moved more than 3 million copies since its launch 3 years ago. Additionally, the publisher revealed it has donated more than 720,000 to charity via This War of Mine and Children of Morta's charitable DLC.
It Takes Two from Haze Light has moved more than 1 million copies since its March 26 release.
All right. Apex Legends is finally going to be on your iPhone or Android device. EA has announced that it's going to be heading to regional beta testing later this month.
We're going to regionals!
Yeah, it's the All-Valley Apex tournament.
And Glee Club will be there.
Oh, yeah. Like PUBG Mobile, it's not going to be crossplay. It's going to be a standalone experience. So you're not going to be able to play against mobile players on your PC and console. Well, it's not going to be like Fortnite.
Okay, so I feel like that's better, though, walling mm-hmm. off mobile where yeah. you don't necessarily... Like, some people will have the controllers, some people won't. Mm-hmm. Like, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense to be like, yeah, you should totally go up against people that are using a mouse and keyboard. Like,
yeah.
That's mean.
Yeah. Touch this, baby.
That's very bad.
Of course, it will be free to play.
Yes, of course.
And EA confirmed that Respawn is leading to dev, so they're not farming it out to another studio.
Oh, okay, so they are handling it internally.
Yeah, which is actually different than Battlefield. Remember, we talked about Battlefield last week? Or is that later? Nope, that's later in the show. Ah, spoilers!
Oh no, you spoiled it.
So EA confirmed that Respawn's leading dev, and they are going to be doing it. So it's established Apex Legends team and other partners.
I would imagine that they're likely working internally with other studios within EA, because mm-hmm. there are a number of really, really talented mobile development within EA proper.
In fact, let's jump down to that right now. So it's all the way down L.
On
L.
All right.
On our notes.
So L on our notes. Oh my god, our notes are so much. All right, EA has announced that Battlefield is getting a dedicated mobile game in 2022, which will be separate from the console and PC game coming this year. Industrial Toys is working with DICE to create the game. So with, you know, successes like PUBG Mobile and Call of Duty Mobile, EA is smart to be bringing both Apex and Battlefield to phones and tablets.
Yeah.
It is still a very good thing to wall off these experiences from the mainline experiences, because mobile does not handle in the same way that everything else handles in.
Yeah. We're actually going to cover a blockchain story.
You know, we don't cover blockchain all that often.
It's such a... When someone says the word blockchain, my part of my brain shuts down.
Oh, I just glaze over at this point because we've been, how many blockchain stories have we been pitched since 2015?
So many.
Too many. So this one is interesting, though, because this really further cements that Ubisoft does tend to be an early adopter of so many different kinds of technology. So this is a Ubisoft story. Ubisoft has joined the Tezos?
We'll go with Tezos.
Tezos, sure. Blockchain ecosystem. And this isn't the first foray for Ubisoft into blockchain because, like I said...
Yeah. They're always there on the bleeding edge.
They're always there on the bleeding edge. So what's going on here?
So Ubisoft is a founding member of the Blockchain Gaming Alliance. That's where they were before. Mm-hmm. They previously partnered with Ultra, which is a blockchain distribution company. So that's fun. The latest venture is going to see Ubisoft become a, quote, corporate baker. And every time I hear the word baker now, I can't stop thinking about the QAnon documentary.
Oh, I don't want to talk about it because that's exactly what I was thinking of. I'm like, ew, this is an 8chan thing. I don't like it. Mm.
So they're going to be what's called a corporate baker in the Tezos ecosystem, which helps validate blockchain transactions.
Oh, okay.
So I actually did some research on this.
All right, so walk me through it.
There's a complicated interaction between Tezos users and bakers and then corporate bakers. So there can be individual bakers and then there's corporate bakers. So baking...
But are there butchers? And are there candlestick makers?
Probably. Baking is the Tezos term for signing and publishing blocks on the network. In effect, bakers and then the larger corporate bakers maintain and facilitate the network.
Okay, so baking is the same process as mining Bitcoin, but there is a really, really, really big difference. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have the energy consumption and hardware needs. So if you don't have enough Tez, also called XTZ, you can safely delegate...
Say it the American way.
No.
No, trust me, say it the American way.
XTZ?
Ecstasy.
Ew.
Yeah.
Gross. I don't like that. Nope. No, XTZ. And I'm not saying it the American way. You can't make me.
Okay. I just wanted you to hear the way that rolls off the tongue.
Yeah, if you're American.
Yeah.
You can safely delegate the Tez you have to a baker for a proportional return.
Yeah, so...
So you can essentially, like, farm it out?
Yeah, so essentially you've got these bakers who are then responsible for the mining piece of it.
But it's not mining in the traditional capacity.
No, it's not.
Because it doesn't require...
It doesn't require GPUs. It doesn't require a huge energy consumption.
You know, I like that. Mm-hmm. I like that it doesn't require the energy consumption because cryptocurrency is such a wasteful... It's so wasteful in terms of its environmental impact.
Yeah.
Which I could talk about literally all day.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so the publisher has joined the network via its Strategic Innovation Lab, which... We've talked about before this show. I've written about before. The Strategic Innovation Lab at Ubisoft is such an important piece of the work that they do because they're constantly pumping money into research and development and looking forward at what's new and interesting in technology and how can we integrate it into making better games and better services.
Mm-hmm.
So this is in an effort to identify and develop intersections of blockchain and gaming.
Yes.
That's already something that is relatively well known in terms of its, well, well known for people that understand blockchain. You know, this is something that already exists in like Pokemon Go.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right? Pokemon Go is probably the biggest proponent of blockchain where they're very transparent that, you know, like, yeah, all of the virtual items that you have are on blockchain.
Mm-hmm.
It's super duper important.
Yep.
So Ubisoft is one of 8 corporate bakers in the Tezos network.
Yeah, at least those are the 8 that there were 8 that they put in the press release. I assume that that's all of them. They didn't say including. It was they showed
8.
What looked like a full list.
This one's kind of sad.
Mm-hmm. Bandai Namco is closing its Santa Clara office by April 2022. Employees have been given until the end of May, so next month, to decide if they want to relocate to the new location, which is going to be in Southern California.
Ooh.
Yeah. Bandai Namco told VentureBeat this decision has been made to enable different group companies within the Bandai Namco group to integrate and open new opportunities for cross-collaboration across its entire portfolio in both the digital and physical goods sector. That is the most corporate-y corporate speak I have ever heard. The company does expect all employees in the new office, so if you are currently in Santa Clara, you will need to relocate, but they are going to allow for flexible remote and work from home until April of 2022.
That's crappy news.
Yeah, it's not great.
That's not great. Like, if you're in Santa Clara, why in the hell would you want to move to Southern California?
Yeah.
Like, I wouldn't.
Yes.
I'd stay in Santa Clara.
Yeah.
All right. This is really fun. Spiritfarer, which our youngest daughter has had this renewed interest in mm-hmm. over the last little while, developed by Thunder Lotus, has sold more than 500,000 copies.
You love to see that.
I do love to see that. It's such a special game, and it has been really interesting to watch our littlest play it, because she's coming to terms with what grief is and what death is, and she's doing it in a video game. It's in a safe space.
Square Enix has decided that it's going to participate in E3 2021, adding one very large missing publisher to the roster, which is still missing
one.
Many publishers.
So many publishers. This one's really weird. Mike, I'm gonna throw this one to you, because this one's a weird one.
So Apogee is back. What? The publisher behind such notable things as Shareware. They did create the whole Shareware concept.
They did. They absolutely did. You know what else they did?
Duke Nukem.
Commander Keen.
Mm-hmm. Wolfenstein 3D, the original Wolfenstein 3D.
Has risen from the grave.
Yeah, so the original Apogee rebranded itself as 3D Realms, which is still in operation, separate company. Scott Miller, who founded Apogee, is back at the helm alongside Terry Nagy, to whom Miller sold the Apogee name and brand in 2008 after the 3D Realms rebrand in 2006.
This is why I handed this back to Mike, because it's just, I can't follow the logic.
Yeah, the new Apogee has announced its first game, Residual, from a one-person studio called Orange Pixel, and three other indie games have already been signed. So they're looking to be the new indie publisher.
I mean, that's fine. There's always room for more indie publishers, because there's so many great indie games. So yeah. I'm glad to see it, but also, what?
We'll see how that goes.
Yeah, that's a weird one. Speaking of weird, Blizzard VP and Overwatch director Jeff Kaplan has announced his departure after 19 years at the company. Stepping into his rather large shoes is Aaron Keller, who is also a veteran Blizzard developer and a founding member of the Overwatch team. This worries me.
Yeah, I mean, for me too, Jeff has been the face of Overwatch. He's a beloved figure in the Overwatch community.
Absolutely.
The fact that Aaron Keller is taking over, that he is also well integrated into the Overwatch team, and this is just another opportunity for us to remind people that one person, even if they're the face of the team, is not the whole team.
No, certainly not. No, absolutely not. But
especially on a project like Overwatch.
Yeah, Overwatch is enormous. There's so many people involved in that. And auteurship is not something that Blizzard does anyway. That's not really their jam.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really know what Blizzard's jam is anymore, mind you. So what do I know?
Yep. It's making us happy with seasonal Blizzard's Diablo stuff.
Diablo!
Diablo, stay a while and listen. Because those were quick hits.
you had to go for it, huh? You just really, you had to punctuate
those
it.
Were quick hits.
Nailed it. And now it's a break. Virtual Economy is an F-Squared initiative, and along with pro bono business consulting for up-and-coming developers, it's a way we are working to give back to the community that has already given us so much. To find out more about F-Squared and the services we can provide, including pitch prep, media training, mock reviews, and business strategy guidance, visit our website at fsquared.biz. And we are back. We have two more stories left for you on the bottom of the show. On the bottom of the sea.
Under the sea, under the sea, darling, it's better where business is wetter, take it from me.
Business is wetter? Oh, God.
I will not explain that on this show.
I don't know if I want that explained to me personally.
Well, you see.
Nope.
Mm-mm. When a P&L loves a balance sheet.
We are wow.
They make some cash flow.
What? All right. Reluctant. Low bones. Low bones. Okay.
Oh.
This is not a low bones kind of story, though, because Epic is making news again. And it has nothing to do with the lawsuit.
Which starts in, like, 9 days?
Wow, time sure flies when you're stuck inside.
It's true.
Okay, so the Epic Game Store now has a dedicated app section coinciding with the release of a number of new non-game applications, including
Spotify, iHeartRadio, which is not iBrokenHeartRadio because we're on there now.
We're on there now.
Yep. The open source browser Brave.
I have not played with Brave. I should check that out.
Yeah, it's a gaming-focused browser.
What? There was another one that was a gaming-focused browser. I can't remember what it was.
2D to 3D digital pixel art converter KenShape, digital painting app Krita, and this is the biggie.
This is the biggie.
Itch.io.
So the itch.io news is big for a few reasons. Itch is anti-DRM.
Mm-hmm.
Steam shot down the Itch application 5 years ago. Let that sink in. 5 years ago. Remember we talked about first mover advantage? 5 years ago. Via the Greenlight program. And Epic is taking a whopping, it's 0% on itch.io sales.
Yeah. That's pretty 0%. Also, there's another piece of the story where someone jokingly put the Epic Game Store app on Itch.
That's actually really funny. Yeah. that's really funny.
Yeah.
Okay. So let's talk motivation here. What is the motivation behind this?
I think this goes back to our conversation last week, where if we just look at this through the lens of public companies, where profit is the bottom line, returning value to shareholders is the bottom line.
Which is the only bottom line that matters. In terms of optics, in terms of how they report their financial earnings and everything like that, you cannot compare that to how a private company conducts itself.
Absolutely. So because Epic is public and has goals that exist in addition to financial goals.
Mm-hmm.
Now, remember, this is also the company that released Core in early access.
Yeah.
From Manticore, right? And that is a metaverse type app. Remember, Epic is trying to build its own metaverse with Fortnite and welcomes in Core, which is about building a metaverse. So making the Epic Game Store a meta-metaverse.
What? That's too meta.
But having itch.io there, Epic is trying to, in my opinion, Epic is trying to A, lift the visibility of some things that are good for players and good for developers.
Mm-hmm.
And Itch does that. And because Itch had that, remember that huge bundle they had?
Oh yeah.
Last summer?
Oh yeah, I have all of those games. I still haven't played all of them because there's
thousands, right?
There were so many games in that bundle. Ridiculous. For racial justice.
Yeah, absolutely. So there was that, and now having Core there, what I see Epic doing is living its own talk.
Does this come down to values?
I think it comes down to values, and I think it also comes down to gearing up for the lawsuit with Apple. It's like, we did this. We put this other storefront
in our
store because we think it's the right thing to do. And we're not taking
a damn thing from it, because it's more important to us that we build awareness for itch.io's excellent indie games. And also, you know what this also does? Is it continues to help provide awareness for indies.
Mm-hmm.
It really does. And you'll be able, I'm really interested to see in about, I want to see this in like 6 months. I want to see this in 6 months where they come back, like Itch comes back and tells us how well things, or if it did any movement at all.
Yeah, if it didn't, we want to know that too.
And we want to know that too. But I really do feel optimistic because this comes down to Epic really just living its values out loud.
And again, Spotify, I can't imagine Epic's going to be taking a cut from anything for Spotify or iHeartRadio or anything like that.
No.
My question for you is, what do you think having this app category, because they did create a new category in the App Store that's just, or in the Game Store.
Well, Steam has that.
Sure. What does having that app category do for Epic?
You know, I'm not entirely certain what that's going to do for Epic yet, because we don't have the data. Mm-hmm. I don't even know what that looks like for Steam.
That's a good point.
So it's not even necessarily comparing apples to oranges. We just genuinely don't see a lot of transparency around how Steam has handled its app-focused stuff, like you need a budget, and they have a bunch of game creation software over on Steam as well. What it could end up doing is creating this holistic ecosystem where we're pulling in 2D and 3D applications. We're looking at, you know, we're looking at Krita, and then you have itch.io. All of those things could potentially feed into one another, which could feed right back into the Epic Game Store, which could potentially also help feed into the Unreal grants.
Absolutely. I mean, from my perspective, the more reasons you give people to come to your store, the better off you are.
Diversification is super important. If you give people more reasons to come to your company, to your store, whatever, they're going to stay.
Absolutely. All right, our last story of the day, I actually wrote a big piece of analysis. It started on day two of my Fauci ouchie, so I was out of it. But I wrote a big Twitter thread because I caught something that I didn't think anybody else had caught yet.
It was a really interesting conversation that you ended up having with Ars Technica's Kyle Orland.
Right. So I saw something in the notes. Kyle found something else. We ended up parsing it. And we're going to have a little conversation because remember when we talked about how the information that popped up about Epic came from Apple's legal filings?
Yeah, absolutely.
And that was slanted in such a way to make Epic look bad.
Yeah.
Then you've got, and we talked about how a lot of the times we get information from public companies.
Mm-hmm. And it's investor relations is still public relations.
Exactly. So it has a certain spin.
Of course.
So CD Projekt announced its fiscal year 2020 earnings. Mm-hmm. And boy, this drives home the point that there is so much, there can be so much spin and obfuscation in financial documents.
Because how deeply was this information buried? It was like on page 70, wasn't it?
So it's a 90-page document, including front cover and back cover. So the PDF is 90 pages long. Mm-hmm. And of course, up front, you've got your basic earnings information. I'll just quickly run through a couple things. Their revenue increased by a factor of 4. Their cost of goods sold was up by a factor of 3, but that's also related to Cyberpunk. Operating income was up by a factor of 6. Net profit was up by a factor of 6.5. EPS jumped by a factor of 6.5. If you want the specific numbers on that, I put them all in the analysis on virtualeconcast.com.
And you should we included that in the show notes as absolutely well, so you should definitely go take a look at that.
But on page 40, this is the first place where they, I think, it might not be the first place they mention it, but it is the place where they specifically identify how much money they gave out in refunds. And on page 40, it's just from their Help Me Refund program, which was the money that they gave out directly. And we determined, okay, this does not include, obviously, any returns that were authorized through Sony, Microsoft, or Epic, or Steam.
Yes.
All right? It did not look like they had revealed that. Down on page 73 of 90 is where Kyle found these provisions that does mention returns, but again, the language around it is extremely obfuscated.
It's such, like, I read this, like this direct quote, and I read your story, obviously. This is the most convoluted language that I think I've ever seen.
Yeah, it's...
it's very convoluted. So, since this is your story, walk us through what these provisions actually mean.
Okay, let's start just with some of the numbers on the Help Me Refund stuff. Because yeah, that's the first absolutely info I found.
Okay.
The Help Me Refund stuff, and I'm just going to talk in U.S. dollars if, you want to see what the Polish zloty amounts are, like the original amounts, that's fine. But I'm just going to talk about it in U.S. dollars. So the refund program themselves cost them $2.17 million in refunds. There was a little bit extra for running the program that is revealed later on.
Sure.
But that's just the refunds.
Okay.
We also know from their earnings call, they only refunded directly about 30,000 copies.
Yep.
We also know that as of the end of 2020, they had moved 13.7 million copies.
Oh my God.
So it's well under 1% for how many they refunded directly. Okay?
Okay, so, I'm following you. That's
so
just,
now...
wow.
They have both short-term and long-term provisions for refunds.
Uh-huh.
So, based
does
on
does this include burying Cyberpunk in the desert?
Not yet. Although it could for 2021. We shall see. They're not ready to give up on it yet. E.T. wants company.
That's such an esoteric reference.
It is.
For any young people that may not be familiar with video game history.
Well, they
the
dug
80s.
Up those copies not that long ago, right? It was only the last 6 or 7 years. There was that expedition out into the desert.
We're olds.
I know.
We're the olds.
So there are these provisions for refunds, and they're broken up into short term and long term. Now, the short term is essentially adjustments to any of the revenue reports that they got from Sony, Microsoft, Epic, Valve, right? On digital copies that were refunded. Because the way that works is you get a report every X period of time, and it varies depending on the storefront.
Right.
And what happens is they show all the money that came in. Mm-hmm. So here's what you earned.
Yes.
And here is what they're dinging you for on chargebacks or refunds.
Right.
So, for instance, if you had $100,000 in sales and $1,000 refund, your net is going to... they're going to show you the net. They're going to work it all out for you. It's a complete report. But at the end of the day, you know, they're not just taking money back. You don't have to pay them back. It just comes out of your lump of money that you get from them at the end of a reporting period. So, remember, the game came out December 10th.
Yes, it did.
I don't know when the reporting period closed for December, if it was December 31st or if it was earlier in the month. I think it was earlier in the month based on some of the language, but again, the language is very obtuse. So, based on that, we know that the Q4 allocation for refunds was $10.65 million.
Yes, that is what I am reading.
So, they sold 13.7 million copies.
Yes.
They only refunded in 2020 about 13 million.
Okay.
All right. And their total revenue...
They refunded 13 million, you said?
$13 million out of... Hold on. I wrote this down. It's in my write-up. There was something like... I don't have it in here.
Okay, that's fine.
But it was like $500 million. It was $550 million was their total software sales in 2020.
Okay. Sorry, I'm
trying to... Oh, here it is. $563.7 million in software sales in 2020. It is here.
Okay.
So just keep that in mind. So their refund program plus 2020... was only $13 million out of $563.7 million.
Okay.
So a tiny drop in the bucket.
That's a very small drop in the bucket.
Right. But they also have what's called long-term provisions. Now, this is where the language gets extremely obtuse.
Yeah. This is the thing that really confused me. So yep. I'm looking forward to you walking all of us through this just intensely frustrating language.
Okay, so here's the language first. This estimate, which is about $38.3 million US, this estimate was based on information obtained from distributors concerning sales to retail distribution networks, retail sales to end customers, number of copies present in various distribution channels and warehouses, as well as the distributor's professional judgment concerning expected sales throughout 2021. So let's break this down. Retail distribution networks. That is not just brick and mortar. I checked with a source in the industry who knows this stuff really well. And I said, so retail, do they mean brick and mortar or do they mean all retail? And what this person said to me was, no. As far as they're concerned, PlayStation Network, Xbox Marketplace, Steam, Epic Game Store, those are retail distributions because they deal with the consumer.
Right, because those are the networks.
Right.
Okay.
So, concerning sales to retail distribution networks, retail sales to end customers, again, that doesn't just include brick and mortar, it includes digital.
Why did they put this language in such a way, though?
It's not incorrect language, but it is obtuse.
But it just, it's needlessly complex.
Right. Now, if it were me and I was writing for clarity, I would have said digital and physical.
Yeah.
But they didn't because they're not trying to be transparent. They are trying to be obtuse.
Right.
Because the less clarity you have...
The easier it is to just walk past it and be like, this is too complicated.
Right. Number of copies present in various distribution channels and warehouses. Now, here's why this is important. Because Cyberpunk failed at launch and... We talked about how that was going to flatten the curve, the decay curve.
Yeah.
And the tail, flatten the tail.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to hurt the decay curve. We know that that game is selling for much less than they anticipated it to.
Mm-hmm.
That has two effects. One, if the game isn't selling well and the price goes down, there's such a thing as reserve pricing or price protection for retailers.
Yes.
And what that means is there's an arrangement between the publisher and the wholesaler, the publisher and the retailer. And if the price goes below a certain point, then that publisher or that retailer is entitled to rebates that essentially cover the difference between the minimum cost and what they have to actually sell it to move the inventory. Remember, holding stuff in inventory has a cost. Inventory costs are very significant for major retailers.
Absolutely.
So if you're talking about a Best Buy, a Target, a Walmart.
Warehouses are finite.
Right. And Amazon, those costs are very high.
Mm-hmm.
They build quickly. And when you're talking about volume at this scale, those costs are significant.
Certainly.
So that's one thing. The other piece of that is if they were anticipating on resupplying in 2021 because the game was moving well and selling still close to MSRP, if the game had dropped to, let's say, 40 as opposed to 20 or lower, then it would still be moving through the channel. In a normal way. In the way we see successful games, Call of Duty.
Normal decay curves.
Like normal decay curves. I wouldn't say Grand Theft Auto 5 because that game has defied everything.
That game is so weird. And the fact that we were talking about it last week because it was a top category on Twitch.
Yep.
Still. What?
Yeah. So I would say they probably anticipated a sales pattern similar to The Witcher 3.
Sure. And The Witcher 3 has certainly had a very healthy long tail.
In fact, we know that last year, 2020, was the second best year for The Witcher 3, behind mm-hmm. only 2015 when the game launched.
And the reason behind that is because of the ridiculously amazing Witcher Netflix series that really got people interested in the game again, mm-hmm. or got people interested in the game to begin with.
And we know that CD Projekt has cyberpunk aspirations for something similar, right?
And I covered that in my analysis of Red 2.0.
You sure did. So there's the two halves of the retail problem there. You've got the reserve pricing, which costs them money, and you've got the lost sell-in, because they don't need to resupply and retailers won't purchase more because Certainly. They don't need any more.
Yeah, because...
And they can't get rid of everything they have.
Exactly. And this is where the difference between sell in versus sell through becomes an important granularity.
Now, we also know that retail was only 10% of the total units sold for CD Projekt in 2020.
The vast majority was digital. 90% of it was digital.
Now, here's the last one. As well as a distributor's professional judgment concerning expected sales through 2021. Which, in part, on the brick-and-mortar side we just talked about, but on the digital side, when is this game going to be back on PSN?
If ever.
So that's a big piece of the puzzle.
That comes down to quality concerns. And honestly, this comes down to PlayStation saying, fool me twice.
Exactly. So what we know is this is a provision. It is not an actual amount at this point, but they have carved out $38.3 million US.
Just in case.
Now, that isn't just returns. We know that some of the returns in 2020 were reflected on 2021 reports. So some of that money is real already.
Yep.
But in terms of this is a conservative estimate of how much they could spend. Even if they spend every dollar of this provision,
it's still... tiny.
It's 9% of their total 2020 revenue. That doesn't even include their 2021 revenue.
Okay, so this is why our episode title is what it is.
Yes.
Now, one of the things that you did not put into the notes that I kind of want to touch on is investor confidence.
Sure. So that's a good point. The stock price right now is around 175 zloty. And at its peak, as we talked about multiple times, it was I think it closed at like 425 the week before Cyberpunk came out. The last time it was this low was January 2019. So they have lost millions upon millions of dollars in market capitalization. They have undone a year of significant growth in the company,
Absolutely.
So,
and they're in the midst of having to deal with investors suing them.
Actually, 2 years. 2 years of significant
two
growth.
2 years of significant growth. That's correct. So
there's two lawsuits that have been filed against them because of deceptive comments made about the status of Cyberpunk.
Because they talked out of both sides of their mouth.
Absolutely.
And it was, listen, we have spoken at length on this show and on our site about the deceptive practices that CD Projekt ended up pursuing, which was deeply unnecessary. Mm-hmm. It was deeply unnecessary. If there is one thing that you and I have learned over our many years of reporting on this industry, it is that both media professionals, investors, and consumers alike value transparency.
Absolutely. The other thing we know is that, if all of these were returns, but even if you look at the number of copies, so 30,000 copies directly through their refund program, and then another 140,000 copies or so directly. So it's 170,000 copies, mm-hmm. right? Total.
Still a drop.
Their refund rate, by the way, this refund rate, a little bit high, but considering how high profile the failure was, that refund rate, not that bad.
No, it's really not. It's kind of shocking that it is as low as it is. I would have expected it to be a lot higher, but if there is something that, again, that I've learned as a consumer myself, it is that returning stuff is way too much of a hassle.
It's a pain in the butt. And especially when people tried once and were denied by Valve and Sony and Microsoft until changed.
It turned into a sunk cost.
It did.
It turned into a sunk cost where people could just look at it and be like, all right, well, I just won't make this mistake with CD Projekt again.
Yep. Or they will because gamers tend to have very short memories. But here's the thing. They made a calculated decision. Do we hold the game? Do we delay it one more time and hurt consumer sentiment and lose the money that we need in 2020? because they got all that money. They had an amazing year, and you can look at the specific numbers. I ran down the growth, but can just look at the size of the numbers.
There's the reason why I brought up the investor confidence, though, is because this strategy worked, kind of.
And exactly. That's why the episode title is what it is. They met their financial goals. And shipping Cyberpunk in 2020 helped them make their financial... At what cost? And that's a long-term... It's going to be a long-term conversation, right? We won't know. I think that consumer confidence should remain very skeptical. You are only as good as the last thing you make. And Cyberpunk, when they were working on Cyberpunk, the last thing they made was The Witcher 3. Whatever they do next, the last thing they made was Cyberpunk 2077, and it was an unmitigated disaster.
Yeah. And I think that... If nothing else, the media, those of us that have been doing this for a long time, especially, we don't forget.
No. We don't forget. I hope not. Although people are still writing breathless previews of games that they've barely seen.
Yeah, that's another conversation for another time.
It is.
So thank you for your most excellent analysis. I always appreciate it you walk us through the finances and help us to understand obtuse corporate language, because I am, in fact, not the person to untangle obtuse corporate language. So this has been episode 80?
80.
Holy crap. We're going to have to do something really special for episode 100.
Yep.
This has been episode 80 of the Virtual Economy Podcast. You can follow us on Twitter at Virtual Econcast. I am at Amanda Farrow, and I am at back on at Twitter.
Yes, you are. And I am at Footerish, FUTTERISH. And I never left. It's like the Hotel California, man.
Oh, that's a really bleak reference. Oh no. You can subscribe to our RSS feed at virtualeconcast.com, and that doesn't just include the podcast. That includes all of our writing as well. And hopefully when I become unburied in other work, I will be able to, I don't know, get back to writing on Virtual Econcast. But if you would just like to listen to the podcast, which is totally fine with us, you can find us on all major podcasting platforms.
Yep, we're on Spotify, we're on iHeartRadio, we're on Apple Podcasts, we're on Google Play, we're on Stitcher, we're on Pocket Casts, we're on, all right in the face. yeah, we would love it if you subscribe, and if possible, review the show. We do love to know what you think. And along those lines, please DM us with questions.
You can DM us at Virtual Econcast or send us an email at podcast@fsquared.biz. If you have super secret information for us, you can also hit us up on Signal. Just DM us on Virtual Econcast and one or both of us will give you our Signal numbers.
Yep. And as we talked about, we're writing on the Virtual Econcast website. That's virtualeconcast.com.
If you'd like to support the show further, you know, we have Ko-Fi. Ko-Fi?
Coffee?
Ko-Fi
/virtual economy.
So you can purchase stickers
mm-hmm.
on our on
we have virtual economy stickers. They're rad. Do.
They're super cool. I'm absolutely in love with these stickers. They're most excellent. And you can support us either monthly or just as a one-time donation. Currently, we are looking to raise a bunch of money so that we can start transcribing these conversations.
So we can start paying for a transcription service because we do not have the time to do it ourselves, unfortunately.
What do you mean we don't have the time to do it ourselves? Don't we? We don't have lives, do we?
It's like the Hotel California, you see.
Oh no, it's always coming back to the Hotel California. Okay, well, we will be back next week.
In the meantime, remember to wash your hands, stay hydrated, get your Fauci ouchies if you can, and be good to one another.
We'll see you soon.